Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics, and the usual two segments up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll be talking to Greg Grandin, who is teaches Latin American history at NYU. We'll talk to him about what's been going on in the southern portion of this hemisphere. Lots of action in Honduras, in Venezuela, as always. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Barbara Ehrenreich, one of the finest journalists we've got in the United States of America today, and talk about her latest book, Brightsided: How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. A very entertaining book, but also a serious and critical one. And I don't know, as someone who always kind of liked Freud's statement of the goal of psychoanalysis was to turn hysteria into ordinary unhappiness, that always seemed kind of un-American, but I always had a sympathy for that gloomy Central European point of view. And we'll have Barbara Ehrenreich on in about half an hour to talk about the pathologies of American optimism, and that is a long story going way back. Before all that, just a few words on the economic news. I do have a full program today, so I'm going to keep these opening remarks on the short side. First, there was an interesting article in the New York Times earlier this week reporting that Congress has done absolutely nothing to reform the credit rating industry. You may recall that the credit rating industry helped give us the recent financial crisis, which, though ending, has left behind quite a toxic economic residue. The rating industry is paid by the issue of securities to rate them, give them grades, letter grades, like anywhere from AAA to D for default. Investors then choose whether or not to buy those securities based on those ratings, among other things. You may wonder how objective those ratings are if they're paid for by the companies being rated. The answer is that they're not at all objective. This was frankly discussed in an IM exchange between two Standard & Poor's analysts that was revealed during a congressional hearing back in October 2008, when it seemed like there might actually be some serious financial reforms. That was a long time ago, though. Now we're not having any kind of serious financial reforms. Analyst 1 said to Analyst 2, "That deal is ridiculous. We should not be rating it." Analyst 2 agreed, but explained, "We rate every deal. It could be structured by cows, and we would rate it." In fact, these deals were structured by bankers, who are probably more dangerous than cows. And now that memories of that crisis are receding, Congress has just given up on regulating the credit agencies at all. According to the Times article, that's not so much because of intense lobbying, the thing that has killed or watered down most other attempts to regulate finance, but fear of interrupting the flow of credit. The U.S. economy cannot survive without insanely easy credit. So happy days are here again. Meanwhile, it does look like the recession has ended and some kind of recovery is underway. I've just been looking at several important economic indicators, and their behavior is conforming to the patterns seen in earlier recovery phases. This is true of things like first-time claims for unemployment insurance, which I quote here almost every week. They're up slightly last week, but still in a strong downtrend. But also of industrial production, which is actually surprised me when I looked at that. Still broken, however, is bank lending to businesses for day-to-day operations, so-called commercial and industrial lending. That's contracting, which could put the kibosh on the infant recovery. I still think the job market is going to be the last to get the recovery news, but the worst does seem to be over. Finally, GE Chair Jeffrey Immelt gave a speech on Wednesday at West Point, curiously the same place that our current Nobel Peace Laureate announced his plans to escalate the war in Afghanistan. Immelt said that his fellow CEOs had allowed tough-mindedness, a good trait, as he put it, to be replaced by meanness and greed, both terrible traits. Going on to quote from Immelt, "Rewards became perverted. The richest people made the most mistakes with the least accountability." Immelt lamented the increasing inequality of American society, in particular the dismal fate of the poorest 25% of us. He didn't disclose what he planned to do about it, because no corporate chief would ever endorse taxing the rich and giving the money to the rest of us or using it to fund a generous welfare state. That is just not done. You can issue moral lamentations, but don't do anything about it, because that would be un-American and, oh my God, socialist. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Latin America. That was a bit of Getting Older by The Clean, a New Zealand band from the late 1970s. I can hear a little more of that New Zealand moment with Split Ends at the end of the program. But since I had a birthday earlier this week, I thought I'd play that in honor of myself because I am getting older. Not, of course, that anyone is, any of us aren't getting older, but nothing like a birthday to remind you of the fact. We're now joined by Greg Grandin, who is a professor of Latin American history at NYU, an author most recently of the book Fordlandia, the biography of Henry Ford's attempt to build a fantasy industrial community in the Amazon, which ended in spectacular failure. Welcome, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
You working on any books now?
No, just catching up with different things.
That's good. So, lots going on in the southern portion of the hemisphere. What is up with in Honduras? It's just...
Well, Honduras, I mean...
It's very hard to follow the news from there.
Well, it seems to be Central America's fate to kind of be flashpoints for larger transnational conflicts. I mean, Honduras, what we're seeing in Honduras is the consolidation of a coup and a real betrayal by the Obama administration. I mean, obviously, Obama's foreign policy has seen a number of different turns... right-wing turns over Afghanistan, acceptance of settlements in Palestine, and his Honduras policy has kind of tracked along with that. I mean, they brokered a deal which seemed to have settled the coup, but it turned out to really allow the people who carried out the coup to consolidate the power and to set the stage for the U.S. to recognize these elections, which happened on November 29th under really dismal conditions, state of emergency. It was the military was conducting the 30,000 troops in the streets. There's charges of fraud, very low turnout, even though the CNN has been reporting high turnout. The fact is that it was, you know, probably around 40% turnout with about 6% of voters voting.
Now for a New York City mayoral election, that would be a strong turnout.
Yeah.
But elsewhere in the world, that's a very poor turnout.
Right, right.
Well, let's go back and maybe not everyone in the audience remembers the coup. So, who was deposed by whom and why?
Well, Manuel Zelaya, democratically elected president, coming towards the end of his first and term limited term, on June 28th, was rousted out of bed and bundled out of the country with a contingent of soldiers at point of bayonets. He was still in his pajamas. And he was thrown out for a number of different reasons. He was governed a kind of center left on a center left program.
He was no raving Bolshevik.
No, right? No, he didn't carry out any foreign adventures. He didn't nationalize any banks or any industries. He raised the minimum wage. He refused to criminalize the morning after pill. He started to regulate open pit mines.
That social issue, was that important?
That was a huge issue, and it was very underreported here in the United States.
The Catholic Church doesn't like that stuff?
The Catholic Church in Honduras is very split. It's very much frozen in the 1980s. You have progressive wing, liberation theology, working particularly around environmental and landless issues, and then you have the Opus Dei wing of the Catholic Church in alliance with the very conservative evangelical sector. And that was the sector.
How big is the evangelical sector in Honduras?
In Honduras, Catholics are the majority, but in Central America, evangelicals and Pentecostal churches have been growing. It's probably around 20%, 25%, though don't hold me to that number, but I would assume it's around there.
And are they allied with reactionary forces in the U.S.?
Yes, as they are in Guatemala and El Salvador. It's interesting. In South America, there's been a little bit of a diversification. Evangelical support Lula in Brazil, a working-class president, and there's a constituency of evangelicals that support Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. But Central America, one of the things that the coup revealed in Honduras is just how frozen in many ways social relations are, very recognizable actors in this coup, ranging from old Iran-Contra luminaries like Otto Reich, who was involved in supporting the Contras in Nicaragua in the 1980s, and people like that, and even Roberto Micheletti, the intellectual author of the coup, has been a senator since the 1980s, and he was a supporter of the Contras and supporter of the U.S. using Honduras as a staging ground for all of those counterinsurgent wars. And then on the other hand, you have liberation theologian priests, you have peasants and union activists, but you also see supporting Zelaya and supporting the really heroic resistance trying to restore him is a is the emergence of these new social movements of the 80s and 90s. And this is where it's a little different. You see gay and lesbians supporting Zelaya. You see feminist organizations, mostly as a result of that decision not to ban the morning after pill, which is a huge thing because when you think, you know, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua have actually been kind of shameful on the issue of abortion, aligning with the Catholic Church to...
Yeah, now, why is that? Is that opportunism or belief?
Opportunism. Just pure opportunism. This was when they were trying to come back to power and they were trying to neutralize some of the criticism of the Catholic Church. And Daniel Ortega really pushed for this Sandinista backing, a very punitive legislation against abortion, 6 to 30 years in prison for women who get abortion. And you see
not the provider, but the recipient.
The recipient. And so this is just as a way of putting in relief what it meant for Zelaya just to not refuse to criminalize the morning after pill. And I should also say just quickly that since his ouster, the Congress has criminalized it and the new president, the de facto president, the coup president, has signed into law the outlawing of the morning after pill.
And you started to say he was also stepping in the toes of the mining industry?
Stepping in the toes of the mining industry, the biofuel industry. Central America in the last 10 years has liberalized a lot of deregulated a lot of its legislation having to do with mining, transnational interests, a lot of it from Canada, but also national in the biofuel, the planting of African palm, and then the open strip, the strip mining for gold and other minerals has really kind of extended throughout Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, but also very much in Honduras. And some of the social movements that have emerged to stop that have been rooted in the Catholic Church in the South and in the North. And Zelaya kind of tilted toward them. I mean, again, he promoted biofuels, but he tried to regulate it. He didn't ban mining, but he tried to regulate it. And this angered a lot of the big sectors within Honduras.
But what you describe sounds fairly mild. So what set these people off to the point where they sponsored a coup?
Well, I just think it's a classic example of elite overreaction to a perceived threat, in which the reaction or the overreaction creates the crisis, much more exponentially worse crisis. I mean, basically, the people who carried out the coup managed to achieve everything that they accused Zelaya of trying to do. They polarized the country. They delegitimated government institutions. They bankrupt the treasury. And they've created the conditions, ironically, where the only way to reestablish legitimacy, and I don't know if we'll ever get to that point, it'll depend on the strength of the social movements, is to actually have a constitutional convention, the one thing that they say that they were – that's how they legitimated the coup. They were trying to supposedly stop Zelaya's push for a constitutional convention to reform the country.
Yeah, well, the claim was that he was sort of turning into Hugo Chavez and wanted to change the Constitution so he could get reelected.
Yeah, that's an out lie. If any constitutional convention to reform the Constitution would have come in the tenure of the next president after Zelaya's term ended, and there was absolutely nothing in the proposals that would have extended or kept Zelaya in power. That was just a pure fabrication.
So his months from running out his term in office. Yeah. Why did they bother?
Well, exactly. I think what it has to do is just the intransigence and hysteria of Honduran ruling class and oligarchy, who any tilt towards trying to open up a notoriously exclusive political system and economic system. Honduras is one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere, one of the most unequal countries. It's been ruled by a two-party system, except for when it had long periods of military rule, since the 1860s. I know we complained about the Democrats and Republicans, but Honduras really, I mean, talk about an elite two-party system that is completely disconnected from any semblance of democracy.
And the United States, after making some sounds of discomfort, has pretty much gone along with all this, right?
Yeah, pretty much capitulated. And the latest is the willingness to recognize the elections. And what you're seeing is because this has always been the people who carried out the coup strategy is to get to the November 29th elections, create facts on the ground, and then eventually the United States and other countries would come around to recognizing them. And what you're seeing is a real split within South America. It's not an even split. The majority of Latin American, South American countries are still opposed to recognizing the elections, including Guatemala, including Nicaragua, but also importantly Brazil and Argentina and Venezuela. But then you're also seeing this kind of new coalition of conservative countries. Panama has a conservative president. Peru, Colombia, Canada, Israel, and the United States have already announced that they would recognize the elections. The U.S. has been hedging a little bit, but the U.S. has actually been pushing other Latin American countries to recognize. And it's clear that once they get a critical mass, the U.S. will recognize the elections.
And so what's going to happen? What were the results of the elections?
The result of the election was that the member of the National Party, Porfirio Lobo, won, and he was expected to win even before the coup, so that didn't really change anything. Most of the progressive forces and potentially progressive parties boycotted it. Hundreds of candidates refused to participate. And it seems like there was actually quite high abstention rates in the election, although it of course hasn't been reported in the media here just how much the elections a ratification to move forward.
And I'm sure the president-elect would like to get back to business as usual, but is that possible?
Well, it's unclear. Just the last couple of days, there was rumors that Zelaya was going to receive asylum from Mexico and that the coup government was going to allow him safe transport out. But then they reneged when it became clear that Zelaya was expecting to still mount political pressure from abroad. The coup government wants Zelaya to sign a document basically requesting political asylum in Mexico and acknowledgement that he is no longer president of Honduras, and he refuses to do that. So things are kind of stalled there. I think what the coup did in Honduras is revealed the lie that there is a democratic alternative to the Latin American left. So even if it succeeds in consolidating its power, it only has done that at the cost of revealing to the world the deeply reactionary and authoritarian face of the people who carried out the coup. I mean, dozens of people have been killed, hundreds have been tortured, thousands have been detained. It's a pretty repressive regime, and you really, I mean, basically the I think the strategy was to reveal to the world a kind of a democratic face, democratic moderns, and what they actually revealed was Cold War Gothic. It's kind of, this return to Cold War authoritarianism. And
yeah, well, it's interesting that the corrupt elections and the repression and the demonstrations in Iran got a lot of coverage here, rightly so. I'm not arguing with that, but not much about Honduras in our media, is there?
Both media and the mainstream human rights organizations really do track the interests of the State Department.
People are not changing their Twitter location to Tegucigalpa.
No, we're not hearing anything about the Honduran bloggers either.
Yeah, no, I guess. I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, professor of history, Latin American history at NYU, and author most recently of Fordlandia. I guess this is a nice segue to talking about U.S. policy, because when Obama was taking office, there was some hope that there would be a somewhat progressive turn in U.S. policy towards the region. The Bush administration didn't pay all that much attention to Latin America compared to previous regimes, but there was some hope that things might take a brighter turn with President Hope and Change. But how have things worked out?
Well, they haven't, and the Honduran coup is in many ways the turning point. I think it's fairly clear that Brazil is. I think it's created a big rift between Brazil and the United States. Look, if there was any hope of the U.S. reestablishing its authority or influence in Latin America, it would have had to do so with a power-sharing arrangement with Brazil, and acknowledging Brazil's rise as a regional hegemon and regional superpower, and making some concessions. And Brazil's been pretty consistent about Honduras, and it's clear that the Honduran crisis has deepened a rift between the Obama administration and
what's the problem with Brazil? You would think Lula is certainly leftish, but hardly radically so. Is it just the rivalry of another power that the United States doesn't like?
I think it's the rivalry of another power, and it's the fact that that Brazil takes multilateralism seriously. They do have a kind of hemispheric program, which entails true sovereignty, which includes the right to ability to invite Ahmadinejad to Brazil and not be lectured by the United States. And yet Obama wrote this lengthy letter to Lula complaining about the invitation of Ahmadinejad. And there seems to be Brazil's stance on Honduras, I think, has also revealed a division between the U.S., between Washington and Brasilia. I think there are very powerful conservative sectors within the Obama administration, coming out of the State Department, the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party, the neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party, that in many ways hold Brazil accountable for a lot of things they don't like in Latin America, particularly the way that Brazil has refused to go along with any attempt to isolate the so-called bad left, be it Chavez in Venezuela or Morales in Bolivia.
Yeah, well, let's talk about those two a little bit. Morales facing election, what's going on?
Well, it's actually a great counterpoint to Honduras, because the one way to think about what happened in Bolivia is that in at the end of 2008, there was an attempt basically to destabilize the Morales government, not unlike what they did to Zelaya in Honduras. There was what was clearly moving towards a crisis situation with this separatist movement in the lowlands that probably did receive funding from AID, U.S. Agency for International Development, and certainly logistical support from groups like the International Republican Institute, and that was squashed. It was squashed both because they overreached and basically engaged in violence that discredited them, but also because Brazil and Chile and Argentina met immediately during the crisis and let it be known that they will not recognize at what was being called a civic coup. That movement was petered out, and it led to the kind of consolidation of Morales's popularity in which it was now which he now capitalized on the last election. I mean, just to put it into perspective, a year ago, Evo Morales couldn't land his plane, the presidential plane, in about a third of the country because of this right-wing mobilization. And now he's won with 63% of the vote. It's the highest percentage and the highest turnout in any democratic election in Bolivian history, perhaps in all of the 20th century. His party has two-thirds of the Senate, two-thirds of the lower house. And it's, in some ways, it's completely hegemonic. It's almost a mirror image of what happened in Honduras. And this is the difference between Central America and South America. South America is distinct in many ways from Central America. South America has kind of ceded Central America to the United States, Central America, Mexico. And when they talk about solidarity and Latin American solidarity, they really are talking about a South American project.
And what do they plan to do with this hegemony?
Well, accelerate change, as Evo said. Land reform is probably on the agenda. They had to make some concessions not to go fast on land reform in order to get the Constitution passed in 2008. Ongoing attempt to gain sovereignty over natural resources, including lithium. Bolivia owns an enormous amount of the world's lithium, which will be essential to any attempt to shift towards electric cars and away from fossil fuels. And what's interesting is that Bolivia has had enormous economic success. It's had 4 years of continued growth. It's had the longest spat of and sustained growth in its history, at least in the last 50 years.
Based on what? What's been driving it?
Well, I think what's been driving it is that it's gotten control over its natural resources through forcing better contracts on foreign corporations that were sharing more of the revenues of natural gas. It's allowed them to build up an enormous reserve relative to Bolivia's economy. And it's allowed to go on a stimulus spending spree without deficit spending, because they've actually have money in reserve that is just in relative terms much larger than the United States. Bolivia is expected to grow 3%. The IMF has indicated that Bolivia is probably going to be the strongest performing economy in South America in the coming year.
Well, speaking of the IMF, they used to dominate the region.
Yeah.
They're considerably weaker now, aren't they?
Yes and no. I mean, I think they've made a little bit of – there's been a little bit of a return of a kind of attempt to reconsolidate its position as a result of the crisis. And you see it in all sorts of ways. They're demanding – that Colombia and Brazil deregulate its attempt to have a control over currency investment. But on the other hand, they're also praising Bolivia, and Bolivia again. It's done everything that the IMF says not to do, and said not to do, and it's been an enormous success, and now it's being praised by the IMF. It's an interesting turn of events.
I guess they don't want to argue with success.
Yeah, can't argue with success.
And finally, we've only got a few minutes left, but Venezuela, how is the Chavez revolution going?
Well, it seems to be in a bit of a pickle. I mean, it's having some infrastructure problems. It's having some corruption problems. It's in crisis, and it's coming up on congressional elections at the end of this year. So which will probably be a referendum on the popularity of Chavez and the revolution. Chavez himself is still personally popular, but it's really, I think we're seeing the kind of perhaps the culmination of the inability and of Chavez to transform that personal popularity into a sustained political project. Now, he may very well recover. He's been in bad straits before, but things are getting tight in Venezuela.
How has the global economic crisis hit Venezuela?
Well, oil prices obviously have gone down from the height of whatever they were, $140, $150 a barrel.
$145 they peaked at. But you know, they're now, what, $75?
Yeah, they're now $75. They're not cheap. Still not that bad. And yeah. Venezuela does budget for I think when it works out its budget, it budgets oil at $30 a barrel. They have a big buffer, a big reserve. I think it probably needs to devalue its currency, but it can't do that until after the election, so that's going to continue to create all sorts of imbalances. I think we're seeing some of the contradictions that are involved on an appreciated currency which is really damping any sustained ability to diversify the economy outside of oil. That's really been a real sticking point, the inability to diversify the economy.
Yeah, that's a problem for all oil exporters.
The Dutch disease.
Yeah, they just can't get out of the oil business, can they?
Yeah, appreciated too highly valued dollar just makes it too easy to buy things rather than make them.
One of the problems with oil exporting countries is that they usually create this very corrupt and parasitical oligarchy that pockets the oil revenues and leaves everybody else polluted and poor. Has that been the case in Venezuela?
Well, it has been the case since 1920s. I mean, this is nothing particular to Venezuela, but this is one of the criticisms that Chavez, high oil prices has allowed Chavez to negotiate, to mediate between different currents within what is broadly known as Chavismo. He could basically defend those who imagine themselves building 21st century socialism in the barrios, funding all sorts of cooperative projects and social projects and the missions and developmental projects. While on the other hand, there has been the consolidation of a political and economic class that has grown rich off of high oil prices. And it seems that we're reaching a point in the Bolivarian Revolution where Chavez's ability to broker between those two different currents is coming to an end. And what we may see is he's going to have to make a decision which path to take.
All right, that's a good note to end on. Thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Greg Grandin, who teaches Latin American history at NYU and author most recently of Fordlandia from Metropolitan Books, right?
Yep.
All right, thanks, Greg.
Great.
Let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back to talk about enforced happiness in the USA.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
Pencil.
Okay, this is Joe Franklin broadcasting on radio station WBAI.
It's 99.5% all natural and preservative free. WBAI FM in New York.
I love this radio station.
And this is WBAI, not only at 99.5 on your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, please do hit our donate button. We're not fundraising now. We will be in a couple of months, but we need all the help we can get. And those little extra donations would really help tide us over until the next round of fundraising. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about enforced happiness with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Why don't you get back into bed? Why don't you get back into bed? Why don't you get back into bed?
Reasons to be cheerful, part three. Summer Buddy Holly, the working folly, good golly Miss Molly, and boats. Hammersmith Polly, the Bolshoi Bally, jump back in the alley, add nanny goats. 80 minutes camels, Dominica camels, all other mammals plus equal boats. Seeing Piccadilly, Fanny Smith and Willie, being rather silly, and porridge oats. I bet her grin and bear it, I bet to come and share it. You're welcome, we can spare it. Yellow socks, too short to be haughty, too nutty to be naughty. Going on 40, no electric shots. The juice of the carrot, the smile of the parrot, a little drop of claret, anything that works. Elvis ain't Scotty, days when I ain't spotty, sitting on the potty, curing smallpox. Reasons to be cheerful.
Why don't you get back into bed?
Reasons to be cheerful.
Why don't you get back into bed?
Why don't you get back into bed? Reasons to be cheerful.
Why don't you get back into bed? Why don't you get back into bed?
Reasons to be cheerful. 1, 2, 3.
And that was some of Ian Dury and the Blockheads' classic Reasons to be Cheerful, which is a nice setup for the next segment. We've got Barbara Ehrenreich, one of the finalist journalists, the finest journalist in the USA, author most recently of Bright Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America, just out from Metropolitan Books. And it's pure coincidence that we have two Metropolitan authors on today's show, I swear. Welcome, Barbara.
Hi, good to be with you, Doug.
I want to play a little clip of the psychoanalyst Martin Bergman from Adam Curtis's Engineering of Consent, his four-part one. The second part of the four-part BBC documentary he did called The Century of the Self, and ask you to comment on it when we get back. It's only about 45 seconds. So let's hear Martin Bergman.
World War II was a major shattering experience because I discovered the enormous role of the irrational in the lives of most people. Now that I can say, that I learned, that the ratio between the irrational and the rational in America is very much in favor of the irrational. That there is much greater unhappiness, much more suffering, much more. A sadder country than one would imagine it from the advertisements that you get. A much more problematic country.
That the psychoanalyst Martin Bergman from Adam Curtis's Engineering of Consent documentary. So do you think he's right, Barbara? Is this a sadder country than the advertisements would suggest?
Yes, that was very interesting. He didn't exactly draw, connect the dots, though, why this irrationality could possibly make us unhappy.
Yeah, he sort of treated those as almost equals without saying how or why.
Yeah. No, I think the theme of irrationality runs very strong through my book, Bright Sided, which is about the positive thinking, which is essentially irrational. You know, it's the idea that things will turn out all right if only we think about them in a sort of positive way, that we can actually alter reality with our thoughts somehow, is very, very strong here. There's no empirical basis to that. Unfortunately, it might be nice to alter the world with our thoughts sometimes. But even though we are the most, quote, positive nation in the world, it's really our reputation and not always for the good. I mean, very often Americans are seen as callow and shallow because of this positive thinking. But we're not the happiest people in the world. And I think one big indication of that is the tremendous use of antidepressants in America. I think we absorb about two-thirds of the world's...
Is it that high, really?
It's just a huge amount.
Yeah, well,
right here.
The OECD put out a compendium of social indicators some months ago that reported that Americans think themselves the healthiest people in the world, but we actually have some of the worst health indicators in the first world. We have the highest rate of mental illness of any of the first world countries they surveyed, some of the worst life expectancy, infant mortality figures, yet we think we're really, really healthy. This combination of almost enforced happiness with irrationality is really just
yeah. Well, what you're saying also
culture.
Overlaps with the other idea of American exceptionalism, that we are the best, that we don't need to learn from other countries because we really are the best, and we have this unique role in the world, this unique mission in the world. And you know that is very much linked into the garden variety positive thinking of Norman Vincent Peale tradition, and you know in our own time so many you know countless motivational speakers and books on how to achieve whatever wealth, health, prosperity through somehow modifying your thoughts.
That- You've been obviously been thinking about this sort of thing for a long time, but you got into this phase of thinking about it after receiving a diagnosis of breast cancer, right?
Yeah, this was about 8 years ago, and the thing that sort of shocked me completely was that there didn't seem to be the kind of feminist support groups I would have gotten some help from.
Well, what about all those pink ribbons? They're quasi-feminist.
Yeah, there's this pink ribbon culture. In which you're supposed to be very positive about your disease. You're supposed to even think of your disease as a blessing, as a gift. That word, I'm not making this up, you know, that cancer is a gift because it will end up making you more evolved and spiritual and sensitive and so forth. Now, if that's your idea of a gift, I would say, get me off your Christmas list. my feelings were distinctly ungrateful.
How could it be otherwise? I mean, are people? I mean, can you tell if people really feel this, or are they just saying this?
I don't know, Doc. You know, it seems to me unlikely, but there, books have been written on the subject. There, you can get yourself a T-shirt on the web now saying "Thank you, cancer." This not just for breast cancer. You know, you can be thankful for prostate cancer or whatever. So, and I thought this was bizarre. I felt it was ugly, really, because we're talking about a pretty terrible disease and one which we don't even know the cause of. Probably environmental, because it's the disease is so much more common in industrialized countries.
Well, but you also suspect yours was, as they say, iatrogenic, right?
Yeah. Well, I had been taking hormone replacement therapy because I had been convinced by very positive propaganda that hormone replacement therapy would prevent heart disease and Alzheimer's. And hey, that's pretty easy, so I'll take this. And then, of course, it turned out in 2002 that it was a big risk factor for breast cancer. A couple of years after my diagnosis, that's what, it turned out. And I suspect that was probably the factor in my own life, since there weren't any hereditary factors that I know of.
Now, the people who embrace the positive attitude towards cancer do so not just out of instinctive cheerfulness, but they actually think there's some therapeutic quality towards a positive
attitude. Well, that's why
they're
so insistent on it, because the dogma was that, and remains, though I think maybe some of us have made a bit of a dent in it, but the dogma is that whether you recover or not, it depends upon your attitude. That a positive attitude will lead to recovery. A negative attitude will weaken you in the face of the cancer. There's just so many levels in which you can refute that. One of them is empirically, there have been big meta studies now. This is from the University of Pennsylvania showing, no, it doesn't make any difference. People who are in therapy, for example, or who are in support groups, are no more likely to survive than those who aren't, though you would expect them to be somehow more positive. Also, the spurious pseudoscientific reasoning behind that is that the immune system is boosted by positive thinking. Everybody's heard that, right? You've heard that.
Oh,
you've got to be careful, and your immune system will be.
This kind of thinking is endemic around here. I got to say, you know, there are people who think you can around this radio station. You can hear people who think you can cure diabetes with positive thinking, or you know, live forever with the herbs that you can find in your kitchen. So, you know, I'm certainly very familiar with this stuff.
The thing about the immune system raised some red flags for me because I have a PhD in, as it happens, cell biology, in particular cellular immunology. And one of the things, you know, that you should be immediately concerned about is that the immune system doesn't fight cancer, or not, you know, not the great majority of cancers in any way, because cancer, you know, is not a foreign invader. That's part, you know, it's our own body cells gone crazy.
Now, there was a theory that circulated some years ago that cancerous mutations happen all the time, and a healthy immune system can sweep them up and throw them into the trash. And then some breakdown of the immune system is what is responsible for the cancer winning.
Yeah, this was the theory of actually a very well-known Australian biologist called the immune surveillance theory. And what he proposed is that little cancer cells are popping up all the time, but ordinarily the immune system just goes out and eats them, you know, the immune cells fight them, and that's that, unless you're weakened. But there's no evidence of this. In fact, here's what's really creepy, Doug, and fascinating to me, is it turns out that at site of a tumor, you do get a lot of immune cells congregating, but not always to do anything useful. There's more and more evidence that, in fact, they can add to the growth of the tumor. They release growth factors. They very obligingly help the tumor to advance. Now, that really set me back as someone with a background in cellular immunology, but, you know, got to deal with it.
Well, it's funny that the immune system is a subject of a lot of fantastic thinking. I mean, there's a way it's sort of personified, and we need to build its muscles up by giving it spinach or something so that it can go out there and fight. But there's also this sort of like almost paranoid protective sense that the world is full of these alien invaders, and like your immune system is going to protect you from it. It's like the same thing that produced Star Wars in Reagan's mind almost.
Well, that's what the immune system evolved to do, is to fight foreign invaders in the form of microbes, chiefly, bacteria and viruses. And it's pretty good at that, the human immune system, but it's also just full of pitfalls. I mean, it can turn against our own body cells, and then you've got an autoimmune disease, like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, or many others. It's something that we need, but it's like harboring a mercenary, a soldier in your house to help defend your home. There are risks in that.
Might turn on you. You can't control the agents.
Right.
I'm speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich, who is the author most recently of Bright Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America, just out from Metropolitan Books. And this discovery of the upbeat approach to cancer led you into exploration of this whole economy and philosophy of upbeatitude. So let's take a historical look at it first. You've got a very interesting chapter where you you talk about the evolution of American thinking in the 19th century from Dürer Calvinism into sort of upbeat Emersonian Eddyism. So tell us a little bit about the birth of optimism, the American spirit.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of sympathetic to the original positive thinkers in America. There were some interesting characters. I mean, the most important of them, actually, is somebody who's very not well-known at all, and that's a guy whose name was Phineas Parkhurst Quimby, who was an artisan. He was not formally educated. He was a clock repairman in Portland, Maine, and on the side, he was also a metaphysician, and also on the side, he was a healer. You know, he would take people who had what was very common among middle-class white people in America then, this kind of invalidism, this vague complex of symptoms, and he would tell them, he analyzed that as a product of the Calvinist religion, the dominant Calvinist religion. You know, people were being told all the time in church that they were wretched sinners, and that the likelihood of eternal torment was well above 90% after death. So he broke through that and said, hey, it's not so bad, you know, and you can choose to be mired down in this dreadful religious melancholy, or you can pull yourself out of it. So I'm down with that, right? Then in the and the transcendentalists like Emerson very much picked up on this and maybe came to it from, you know, for their own reasons too. But by the 20th century, it had turned into pretty much a get rich quick scheme.
But there was also Mother Eddy and her crazy Christian Science.
Oh yeah, a Christian Scientist could easily get to the phone right now and call and say, I'm completely wrong. It was all Mary Baker Eddy who came up with the whole positive thinking outlook. And she was a patient of Phineas Quimby's and was much taken with his method. She was suffering from, a huge variety of illnesses that we might recognize today as somewhat psychosomatic, indigestion, lower back pain, everything. I've had these illnesses, so I don't sneer at them. But, you know, she went to Quimby. She was healed, and then she started doing the same thing. And she was a very effective writer and speaker, so she was able to popularize it in a way that Quimby had not been.
Well, and then the strain of thinking that they unleashed was that the proper frame of mind, the proper thoughts or the proper visualizations or whatever could control, you know, the internal bodily processes, but also can control the outside world. I mean, you could have health and wealth if you just thought correctly, right? This is what is continued to this day.
You know, and this is, it goes back to these 19th century people. It started in recent decades to be called the, quote, law of attraction, as if it were a law of physics, that what is in your mind will attract things to you. So if I focus on $1 million, if I focus, you know, hard enough on that, it will actually come to me by this mysterious attraction. Now, what is this? Well, for a while, they played around with magnetism. You know, it must be magnetic force exerted by our thoughts. As you may have noticed, our heads don't tend to stick to refrigerators, so that's an unlikely explanation. We don't exert a lot of magnetic force by thinking. More recently, it's all been, quote, quantum physics. Don't even ask. I've studied physics. There is nothing in quantum physics that says your thoughts control the universe, or you can make things happen just by thinking them.
But it's an attempt to give a scientific veneer to utter mysticism and nonsense.
Well, you know, why they even bother, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's a kind of a tribute to science, or it's a prestige in our society that they would even bother to come up with these things. But I...
Well, you know, Adorno has these theses on occultism, and one of them is, you know, that they try to be all mystical and spiritual, but they want to weigh the soul at the same time. So there's this long history of this kind of scientific basis for utter nonsense.
Well, also, it sells. I mean, I remember when Larry King had on his show a bunch of people, motivational speakers and coaches, essentially, life coaches, who had been quoted at length in the book The Secret, the 2006 bestseller on how you could have anything you wanted by thinking about it. And Larry King introduces that show by saying, now, tonight we're going to tell you how you can have anything you want just with your thoughts. And don't be skeptical. This is based on science. Now, you're that, wow, you know, even I, you know, my ears perk up. well, what could that be, you know? And this would not have sold as it did in the corporate world, I'm sure, so well if it didn't have this pseudoscientific veneer.
Well, yeah, you do write a lot about how this stuff isn't just individuals. Corporations buy this stuff in bulk or hire motivational speakers at conferences, and there's a whole industry around the power of positive thinking.
Yeah, and that's a big point here. I mean, this is not always voluntary. People at work are, you know, often subjected to this. You've got to be a, quote, positive person or out you go. And so in the build-up to the 2008 financial meltdown, people were fired and people were silenced within the finance industry, for example, for daring to say, I think we've got a problem with our subprime mortgage exposure, or I think this housing boom is actually a bubble. You know, you're out for that.
Yeah, that's un-American. But it also has rather toxic political effects. You quote a Christian motivator named Zig Ziglar saying, mm-hmm. It's your own fault. Don't blame the system. Don't blame the boss. Work harder and pray more. That seems to be the American approach to unemployment, right?
A paraphrase from the Time magazine reporter who reported on one of these motivational conferences. He put it in those words, but I'm sure you could find Zig Ziglar is saying very much the same thing. See, my analysis here is that this really takes hold in corporate America as the age of downsizing sets in, beginning in the 1980s, late 80s, and then increasing ever more. Before the recession, people were just this constant churning out from the corporate world. And how do you manage that? How do you manage people when you can no longer offer them a secure future as a reward for good performance or something? Well, positive thinking was the answer. You bring in the motivational speaker, you put motivational posters up on the wall, and then it's supposed to achieve two functions. One is to prevent bad behavior among those who are actually being laid off. You know, that if you send them to an outplacement firm, and the first thing they get is a big pep talk about thinking positively about being laid off and how it's really an opportunity, just as like cancer is a gift, et cetera. And tell them nothing could be worse than to complain or be negative. I think that stifles dissent very cleverly. The other purpose of it in the age of layoffs is you got the survivors of the layoffs. How are you going to squeeze more and more work out of fewer and fewer people? Which, of course, has become, you know, a real challenge in this recession. And that's where you bring in, again, the motivational speaker comes and tells people to give their all. Give, 120%.
Otherwise, you may be going out the door next, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
I'd heard the story. I think Tom Frank told me a story years ago of people being forced at their jobs to do group readings of Who Moved My Cheese.
Oh, yeah. No, I've heard, I've talked to people who had it distributed free to them at work. And then there are places where they're even supposed to have study groups. And what is Who Moved My Cheese about? Accepting layoffs without complaint.
You've been, I imagine, traveling around, talking to a lot of people as a result of publishing this book. Do you find that there is some sort of hidden tendencies towards critique of enforced happiness? Or is your critique met with surprise and resistance?
Well, I'd have to say I'm pretty surprised at how little hostility there's been and how frequently the response is relief. I countless emails from people I don't know were saying, thank God somebody said it. And there would often be somebody who's been through something horrible, like cancer, layoff and subsequent downward mobility, or bereavement. And they're sick of being told to just put on a smiley face and get with the program and accept it. So I think there's some sort of backlash potentially going on.
Well, let's hope so, because it's time for America to grow up, I think. Thank you for your contributions to the maturation effort. I've been speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich, who is the author of Bright Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America, just out from Metropolitan Books. Thanks for joining us, Barbara.
My pleasure, Doug.
And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this, another bit from the folks down under. The New Zealand group Split Enz, ENZ as in New Zealand, from, I believe, 1977. We'll be back next week. Till then, bye. Thank you.
something.